welcome to the latest episode of the J-Pod, a High Library production. I'm your host, librarian Josh Cohen, speaking with you from the campus of Elizabethtown College in Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania. I'm very excited to welcome my guest today, Elizabethtown College Professor of Political Science, Dr. Fletcher McClellan. Fletcher has been teaching at the college for over 40 years, and I'm pleased to be chatting with him today to talk about the Philip Roth novel, The Plot Against America, and Fletcher's use of that book to talk about U.S. politics in the age of Trump and in the aftermath of January 6th. Thank you for joining me to chat on the topic, Fletcher.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. McClellan teaches the senior capstone in political science and legal studies, as well as courses in American government, the presidency and presidential elections, public policy, and public administration. He has presented dozens of papers at professional conferences on these topics. He is the recipient of the 2020 Lifetime Achievement Award and the 2018 Craig L. Bryans Award for Excellence in Undergraduate Research and Mentorship. And in 2020, Eton College awarded him the Kreider Prize for Teaching Excellence. Fletcher has published many research articles on political science topics, including the one we'll be discussing today, which is titled, It Almost Happened and Might Still Happen Here, Philip Roth's The Plot Against America, which was published in the Journal of Political Science Education in November of last year. And we'll provide more information on the article in our podcast episode description for folks who want to find that article. Fletcher also publishes a regular op-ed column for the Pennsylvania Capital Star newspaper, which you can find online at penncapital-star.com. He's also offered political commentary and analysis to local news outlets, including WITF, Lancaster Newspaper, and to national outlets, including the New York Times and the Washington Post. I'm excited to talk to you, Fletcher, about Roth's book and your use of it in the classroom. I should warn viewers who haven't read the book or seen the HBO series based on the book that there will be some spoilers ahead. So fair warning if you are not familiar with the story. So in this novel, Roth, who was a young child during World War II, focuses the narrative on his actual nuclear family living through an alternative history in which FDR loses re-election in 1940 to the celebrity aviator Charles Lindbergh, who runs on an isolationist, anti-war, quote, America First platform that leads to a pact with Hitler and America staying out of any involvement with the war effort. And the result of this alternate history leads to a nightmare scenario for young Philip and his Jewish family in Newark, New Jersey, and for Jews throughout the United States who face a rise of anti-Semitism, the likes of which this country has never actually experienced. But this is a fictional novel, and I think Roth oftentimes puts himself as a character in his fiction, and this one is very much in that vein, where he is the central character, but it's him as a child. Mm-hmm. And so, Fletcher, you've used this alternate history narrative to talk about Lindbergh having a political platform somewhat similar to Trump's. Can you talk about how you see them as similar and what notable differences mm-hmm. there are?
Yeah, thanks, Josh. Well, both, of course, ran on platforms which were labeled America First. The America First movement and the Make America Great Again movement are very similar. America First in the 30s and early 40s did focus on the U.S. staying out of international conflicts, not being involved in the war in Europe or confronting Nazism. As the movement grew for isolationism, there also were elements of racism, anti-Semitism. It became a fairly large and diverse movement. You had people even like John F. Kennedy and Gerald Ford subscribing to it as college students because of the anti-war platform. Of course, JFK's father, Joseph Kennedy, was an isolationist ambassador for FDR to Great Britain. But then there were also other elements, including the notorious anti-Semite Henry Ford, the manufacturer. Trump's movement really begins with the Tea Party movement in 2010, which was a response to things like Obamacare, and people were concerned, obviously, about government spending and government dictating health care. But there also was, once again, a fairly racial element to this, a response to the achievement of African Americans and having a president, and maybe fearful that there would be more people of color and women becoming president. And of course, Trump carries this through, and he tries to position himself, for example, as anti-war, even though he very well was a supporter of the Iraq War. He claims that he wasn't. Of course, now he's been a supporter of Vladimir Putin. So, you know, saying that he could make better deals with Putin and that Russia could be an ally. So, in this sense, then, Trump's courting of Putin is similar to Lindbergh's relationship with the Nazis. Lindbergh becomes kind of an admirer, maybe not so much of the Nazi ideology, but of of German technology in the military. In fact, he's given a medal by the head of the German armed forces for his support and whatever maybe technical advice he gave. He also was, also happened to be, a pretty strong anti-Semite. So Roth puts the two things together. There was a notorious speech that Lindbergh gave in 1940 and also in 1941 at Madison Square Garden.
We're talking about the real Lindbergh.
Yeah, the real Lindbergh, which kind of blamed Jews and Great Britain for pushing the U.S. toward war. So FDR suspected that Lindbergh, the real FDR, suspected the real Lindbergh as that he was a Nazi. Mm. So you've got Lindbergh and Hitler, you've got Trump and Putin, and you have the movements behind which preceded them and which they propelled further. And I think one of the beauties of Roth's book is that he very painstakingly goes through the history of the period and finds places of where, you know, where he ties the fictional account, the narrative, to actual events. So it makes it sort of natural that you can plug Lindbergh in where FDR was, but certainly pursuing a different course.
Now, it's important to note that the book was published, I think, in 2004, so far before Trump was a serious candidate for office, but folks seem to turn to this book before Trump even became president, like during the campaign. Mm-hmm. I started reading it, actually, then stopped, but I started reading it in the lead up to the campaign, because it was one of those books that people were talking about, partially, I think, because of the slogan that Trump was using, was the sort of America First slogan. And my understanding is that even when it was pointed out to Trump, the history of that slogan, going back to the movement that Lindbergh was a part of, he pretty much said he didn't care. He liked the slogan and was going to use it anyway. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, I don't know. He probably thought he invented it, but I think he probably has he probably had a pretty good understanding of that movement from the kind of policies and things that he's pursued.
Well, he certainly likes to flirt with these ideologies that he will claim ignorance of, or sympathize with ideologies that he will then later claim to be completely ignorant of. So that certainly could be an example. It's important to note that, you know, the historical, so we were talking about Lindbergh, and Lindbergh actually, the real Lindbergh, never actually ran for office, although his father was a politician. But And the my understanding is that the original America First movement pretty much dissolved after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and that that particular event was a catalyst where the general public in the U.S. pretty much was pretty solidly united with the war effort at that point. I'm sure there were still people that were anti-war regardless, mm-hmm. on both the left and the right. Why is it important to talk with students about this America First group, right. from the 30s and 40s and how it's relevant now? And
well, I think the ideas carry forward. They may be presented in different ways or over different media, and the messenger may be different, but the ideas of America as a fortress, or America as belonging only to a single ethnic group or religion, are very much in play today. We've been reading a lot lately about Christian nationalism, about groups who believe that basically America was made by white Christian nationalists to pursue, you know, a fundamentalist view of the Bible. And you know, that traces back to some of the thinking back to the 1920s and 1930s. So, and Roth, you know, even though he wasn't connecting necessarily to Trump at that time, you know, saw the threat of this kind of ideology, whether it's white supremacist or anti-Semitic, and thought about what can we do to prevent it or to stop it from spreading. As he said, Roth said, and I quoted in my article, he wasn't so much interested in the question of why did countries like Germany and Spain and Italy go fascist, and why did Europe turn, you know, at least under Hitler, fascist. But he was interested in the question of why didn't America turn toward fascism with the presence of the America First movement and what was happening in other parts of the world. And so he tried to identify where, you know, were we simply lucky, or what were the elements of resistance in our country that prevented us. Certainly FDR was a huge factor. But, you know, one of the reasons I use this book, it is one of the approaches that I talk about in how to approach and understand and write about politics to political science seniors, is the idea of constructionism, which takes into account concepts like contingency and choice and randomness, alternative narratives. So, you know, it's entirely conceivable that someone like a Lindbergh, who was a national hero, a celebrity, but definitely a national hero. Trump was a celebrity. I wouldn't necessarily say he was a hero, but still, you know, nationally known, and at least many people thought he was a great businessman. He had some sort of skill or expertise. It's very conceivable that someone could have emerged from the climate of the 30s and 40s, advocating a platform that was sympathetic to Nazism, or at least anti-war, and that the course of history could have changed. We certainly have seen enough of this with the differences between the Electoral College and the popular vote in 2000 and in 2016, even this last election, just a few thousand votes shifted, and you would have had a different president in a different direction of history. So, you know, having students recognize the contingency of history and how things could turn out differently if with alternative narratives, and to imagine what, you know, to imagine alternative narratives from today into the future. Could we project, could we change things if we can simply imagine, not simply by, you know, a conventional wisdom or a media narrative, just imagine, you know, how things could be different and plot a path toward that. So that's what I want to get, let students get out of reading the plot against America.
Well, we've certainly seen democratic countries turning towards authoritarianism in recent years. I mean, there's certainly a fear right now in Israel that there might be a weakening of the democratic institutions there if the judiciary there is weakened by Netanyahu's administration. So there's certainly concerns about sort of not just in the U.S. but around the world with countries becoming less democratic. There seem to be stress tests on a lot of those institutions in the U.S. but in other countries as well. It seems like on January 6th that was a test.
Yes.
That we passed, but it seemed like it was it hinged on a decision by Pence, right?
Yeah.
To some extent.
Yeah. Vice President Pence basically decided he wasn't going to go along with the plot. There was fear that Trump would have declared martial law, and basically he was holding the National Guard in reserve and just had loyalist people in law enforcement and the military. I don't know whether our military would have gone along with that. There was certainly a lot of discussion about what could be done if the president really went on his own, talk about invoking the 25th Amendment and things like that. But, it came down to sort of an individual decision by a leader, not to go along. So that's how, razor thin, paths of history can take.
Well, in the novel, that kind of is the situation where Lindbergh's wife seems to be the one that prevents the disintegration of the country, which was a point I think I communicated to you that I had a little bit of trouble buying that the wife of Lindbergh disappears.
Right.
At one point in the novel, and chaos ensues. His vice president takes over and declares martial law, and then has like Anne Lindbergh like institutionalized. She somehow gets out and puts out this speech condemning the vice president's actions, and everything is like reversed.
It is a rather condensed and rushed ending, and she is thrown in that. I would recommend also to your listeners the 6-part HBO miniseries. It's based on the plot against America, and David Simon, who was the showrunner for The Wire, the great HBO series about law enforcement, he was the showrunner for this, and he got to talk to Roth while they were conceiving of the miniseries. And one of the things they wanted to ask Roth is whether they could construct a little different ending than what Roth had put together. And Roth basically said, it's my work, but it's up to you to interpret it however you choose, which I think is what authors would normally say, that he's not protective of it. It's now for the public to make of it what it will. But he didn't object to any kind of alteration of the ending, because he just knew that he just needed to bring the novel to an end. But there are a number of things before we even get to Anne Morrow Lindbergh. I imagine the reason she's sort of pulled out of this is, she, of course, was a novelist, a writer of children's books and so on, was a sympathetic character because of the kidnapping and murder of the Lindbergh baby in the mid-1930s, and went to Smith College. So she had, just a different kind of upbringing and career and perhaps outlook than her husband. So just, taking that into account, maybe that is why Roth chose her to help turn things around. But, he, as I mentioned, he tries to diagnose why America didn't fall into fascism. And obviously leadership of FDR, but, there were Republicans, Wendell Willkie, who was the Republican nominee for president. He was not an isolationist. In fact, he was an internationalist. And it turned out in the actual nomination the Republican nominating convention in 1940 in Philadelphia, there were a whole bunch of America Firsters running, like Robert Taft, but the person who emerged with the nomination, kind of the dark horse candidate, was Wilkie, and he and FDR are on the same page. So there was no outlet for isolationism in that presidential race. So certainly his leadership and, obviously what Churchill was doing. Philo LaGuardia of airport fame, the great mayor of New York during the Depression, he turns up in this. Walter Winchell, a media figure who gave sort of like nightly entertainment and newscasts, but during the 1930s was a very strong opponent of Hitler. These figures appear, these leaders appear both in government and the media to talk about the dangers of Hitler. That's one part of it, but also there's the resistance at home. And, Roth's family goes in all kinds of different directions, as people in the Jewish community did or would have had Lindbergh been president. You had people escaping to Canada. You had people enlisting in the Canadian Army, if the U.S. isn't fighting the war against Hitler, to enlist in the Canadian Army to fight Hitler. You had Philip's father, who is steadfastly believing that America is what it claims to be, that is a land of freedom and justice, and that elections, free speech, calling out discrimination, calling out bigotry where it exists, that America is still a fair and free people. Unfortunately, he's up against a lot. There are all kinds of reactions about, what to do about the threat that's coming from Lindbergh and the American First forces that are behind him. And the family, like the country, is almost on the verge of disintegration. In fact, there is a aunt who marries the rabbi,
Bengelsdorf.
Rabbi Bengelsdorf. And Rabbi Bengelsdorf is in more of a southern heritage, and who believed that Jews in America needed to assimilate more into the mainstream culture. And that's what Lindbergh was about, assimilation, not about, persecution or even worse. So he becomes kind of he joins the Lindbergh campaign. He is appointed to an office of the Office of American Absorption, where his job has come up with ideas and programs to help assimilate American Jews, taking young Jewish youth out into the countryside to learn skills and trades, but basically taking them out of neighborhoods where Jewish traditions are observed, having businesses openly discriminate against Jewish executives, sending them out into the field, basically trying to disrupt and destroy Jewish communities to have them basically blend into the larger culture. So that's what one of Philip's relatives is about. So you have all these different ways of responding to the threat. And, the question really is, which pathway will we choose the next time we face another threat to our American ideals? And that threat could be coming as soon as next year.
The response of the students that you've had, that you've taught this to, how do they respond to Roth's novel?
Well, I think they respond pretty well to it. It is a little bit of a parlor game, it becomes, about the similarities, say, between Lindbergh and Nazism or America Firstism and Hitler. And then you put that alongside Trump and Make America Great Again and Putin. So, you do try to get beyond those similarities, which are meaningful, but still you're missing the bigger point. Obviously, if there is sort of a lesson that, yes, it could happen here, and it almost did happen here, it could still happen again. It may be in a different kind of package or formulation, like if there were a smarter Trump, you know, or a more compassionate Trump, or just someone who is completely different because we have Trump fatigue. Regardless, and as you mentioned, the threats to democracy are growing all around the world. So, you know, that's the bigger lesson about to recognize the threats to democracy, how democracy could unwind slowly or, you know, through some big stroke, but how it could very slowly backslide, and how will we respond?
So I wanted to explore just the topic of the rise in anti-Semitism, which wasn't, as far as I remember, a major issue in 2004. Obviously, there was still anti-Semitism, but there wasn't this sort of surge in anti-Semitism. And I looked this up just to see what the numbers were. And there has been a sharp rise in anti-Semitic incidents over the past 10 years. And what I found from the Anti-Defamation League was that in 2013, there was a number of 751 reported anti-Semitic incidents. That number rose to 2,717 anti-Semitic incidents in 2021. I'd also read an article stating that hate crimes in 2021 were at their highest levels in 12 years, with the highest increase in anti-Black and anti-Asian crimes. And you write in your article about your concern about white supremacists feeling emboldened by some of the rhetoric coming from the far right. Do you see any connections between these statistical increases in hate crimes against various minority populations and the increasingly extremist, often anti-Semitic and anti-immigrant rhetoric coming from the far right?
Right. Oh, absolutely. And, during... If Roth, he could have been, he never really directly identified what the real inspiration for this beyond wanting to tell the story of his family during wartime, and especially the story of his father, who was outspoken and was regarded, and I'm sure there was more than a little bit of stereotyping in this, was regarded as obnoxious, but to him was a hero for standing up for American values and standing up, or at least speaking out against Hitler in real life. But if he was responding at all to the presidency of George W. Bush, who was, of course, on a crusade to against terrorism, when Bush was elected in 2004, the target was gay rights. There were all kinds of referenda at the state level which constitutionalized the right of state government to discriminate against LGBTQ people. And the whole idea was to get out the vote among evangelical whites to use this issue to mobilize them. And indeed, it was probably fairly successful. But of course, a decade later, public opinion on gay rights turned around. And it was less, at least if you're talking about support in 2012 or 2016 or 2020, it's the gay issue is not so much driving anti-gay activists. It is, but it's now there's a very large number of pro-gay rights, pro-human rights activists now that have joined this and have helped to neutralize the issue. So, and of course, now it's not just, you know, anti-Semitism, which is, you know, reached horrifying proportion, but the targeting of trans people and LGBT people generally, but especially trans people. So, you know, we're talking about demonizing the other, finding some group that you perceive as different and having different values, not of this country, not of this nation, maybe not even human. And that, unfortunately, has been part of the American story since our founding. And now, I think, with technology being as direct as it is and the ability of all kinds of hate groups to mobilize and get their message out, it is probably even scarier now than ever before.
Yeah. You mentioned the media landscape, the media landscape in the novel. You have certainly people paying attention to radio and film newsreels to keep up with what was going on, and people are talking in the community, but you don't have anything even remotely resembling social media. Social media as being identified as a major factor for rising in hate crimes, but also rising in this sort of anti-democratic movement spreading, not just in the U.S., but all over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly it's very disturbing. Now, the 30s had more than its fair share of extremist groups and demagogues, advocates of the right and advocates of the left. You had the Huey Long campaign, Every Man a King, but you also had Father Coughlin and other Christian and right-wing demagogues operating at that time. So,
yeah, and Coughlin had a popular radio show.
Yeah, right? You know, so he's feeding these ideas straight to a very large and captive audience. I would say, fortunately, social media gives people who resist also the opportunity to organize. Now, conservative media certainly is dominant in places, talk radio, certainly the dominance of over the years of Fox News, certain kinds of groups like the NRA. They certainly own certain segments of the population. There's nothing that really focuses liberal attention the way that Fox News does or the Murdoch Empire does. But still, people do find each other. And just as there's been mobilization of right-wing extremism, there has been mobilization of resistance. And I just don't see that there's any other way out of this. People have to fight, and very hopefully in a civil, within the realm way, in the realm of politics. But people have to fight for what they believe. They have to call out, hate and call out illegality when they see it, and move forcefully against it.
The idea, though, that in the 30s and 40s, you at least had everybody agreeing on a narrative of what reality was, and that's not the case anymore. It seems to me like, in a lot of respects, we're in a lot worse position than America was in the 1940s. That the threat that Roth explores here as a potentiality, that there was greater strength in terms of the control of, a limited media, mm-hmm. where people were reading the same newspapers, right. Watching the same newsreels. So at least the narrative, even if it was, not always 100% accurate,
right.
Folks were at least agreeing on what reality was.
Right.
It seems like that has changed because, you mentioned so much media out there, so many options from social media to cable news to
right.
podcasts of various kinds, and people can believe whatever they want, whatever version of reality they choose.
No, that's a really good point, and my thinking would only be a theory that back in the 30s and 40s, and even, of course, extending pre-cable, where we only had a limited number of networks, and back then it was only radio, but still only a limited number of networks, a limited number of outlets. You had more control over communication by media elites and, of course, the politicians that they covered. So there would be more of a unified frame of events, but also possible, because of this fairly tight control, also the possibility that that frame could change from anti-war, keep America out of war, keep America out of Europe, to America now is the... we're the victims. We've been attacked. and our way of life has been attacked, and we need to all get behind the war effort, which overwhelmingly in the 40s people did. Today, as you mentioned, the media environment is fragmented. Leadership is extremely fragmented, who people listen to and follow, and including, of course, following each other as citizens participate and can influence narratives through memeing and other methods. So there is no dominant narrative. There are just multiple narratives, which makes it hard to lead.
But not just even narratives of interpretation of events, but just even basic facts.
Yes.
Like this election was won by this yeah. person.
Yep.
The other thing that is a huge difference from my perspective on a major difference between sort of the stability of democracies, but certainly in the United States, is my impression, and you would know this better than me, that people had pretty high faith in government institutions oh. and institutions generally in the 1930s and 40s, and certainly with FDR, that seemed to increase because he increased the reach of the federal government. Now there's the just extraordinary, both on the left and the right, extraordinary mistrust of institutions that makes it hard to have that kind of faith and it seems to weaken the our democratic institutions. Would you? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, even as late as the early 60s, before the Kennedy assassination, you had polls indicating like 80% of the American people thought that the federal government does what is right all the time or most of the time. 80%. You just
wow.
wonder what kind of world that was.
Yeah.
Today, it's barely 20% if it's that.
Yeah.
And it's been that way. It declined beginning with the assassinations and Vietnam and Watergate and has never really recovered except for certain, like crisis events like 9/11.
Right.
So you're right. We're an entirely different world as far as trust in government goes. Now, and it's generational. I mean, you're talking about... Roth is talking about really the boomer generation who came of age during the Depression and the World War, and FDR was the dominant figure. And that generation, I'm not talking about not the boomer, but the so-called great generation, that generation more or less had more of a trusting pro-government, somewhat pro-democratic, and, as... scholars have noted about social capital. This was the generation of joiners, of group. Robert Putnam's book about Bowling Alone, the greatest generation, they were joiners. They were they joined bridge clubs and bowling leagues and the Elks and the Kiwanis and ladies' auxiliaries and you name it. So there was a great deal of solidarity in that generation, which was pinned on faith and trust, not only in government and each other, which persisted until it's replaced by the boomer generation, which is more distracted by television and also has to encounter a much different world and America during the 60s than the 30s.
So I guess my point in bringing that up is that if we're looking at the likelihood of why didn't America become fascist or go toward authoritarianism, to me, the strength of those institutions, the limited number of media, to me, that is decisive to me in terms of like the U.S. and the strength of those democratic institutions.
No, I agree. Roth would probably agree with you, but he would pinpoint the resistance and at the community level. And
yeah.
He was a pessimist about the 60s. I mean, he idolized, romanticized what was going on in Newark in the 30s and 40s and 50s. Saw the 60s, of course, create enormous changes in Newark. There were riots. There was white flight. And so... So, I mean, he would probably go back to the solidarity of communities and families as being the underpinnings of resistance.
Which is a very conservative viewpoint, right?
Yeah.
So I guess we should wrap things up a little bit. I'm curious, are there any other things about this novel that you think are particularly notable?
I think there are a number of set pieces which are brought out in the book, but also in the miniseries. And there's a very good discussion with David Simon by Peter Sagal. It's the accompanying podcast to the miniseries, where Simon talks about his conversations with Roth. So I would recommend that very highly. But there are a number of set pieces. The Roth family travels to D.C. They take a vacation. Yeah. And, you know, Lindbergh is now ascended. And there are people who are just overtly anti-Semitic and don't hesitate to... they get to their hotel room and find that it's already been booked. Obviously, the owners learned that who they are and where they're from, and all of a sudden it's, you know, there's no place at the inn. And so they encounter all these sorts of you know, very hateful encounters, but, you know, there's a guide who helps them, and they manage to make it at least kind of a triumph. So there are these little victories, little, you know, droplets of hope throughout the novel. It is kind of a crushing, overwhelming feeling that you have that, you know, that something very dark is overcoming the country, and of course is affecting Jewish Americans the most. But there, at the same time, are these elements of individual resistance and hope that you know, true Americanism, or real freedom, as our governor now would say, still exists.
Hmm. Well, thank you for talking with me about the novel and your use of it in the classroom. It was a pleasure to talk to you, Fletcher.
It was my pleasure, too. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the J-Pod, a High Library production. I'm your host, librarian Josh Cohen. Be sure to check back in with us for another episode from the Eatown College community. If you have any ideas for future episodes or feedback, please email me at cohenjp@etown.edu.